Commons Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those campaigning for social change. It collects, curates, and distributes the key lessons and resources of progressive movements around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 500 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org. Commons Social Change Library is a 3CR supporter.
You're back with Annie on Solidarity Breakfast, and we've got Ben Kunkler on the line, and your group at Melbourne University are actually being contributed a lovely new resource to the Commons Library, Organising a Remedy for Despair. That's correct, isn't it, Ben?
Yes, Annie, yes, it is. And I'm really pleased to see that there's a record of that history written from below, which I think is really important, because so much of the time when the records are written about, you know, wins like this, which I think amounted to in the end to $45 million of back pay for mostly casual, insecurely employed academic staff and professional staff.
At Melbourne University?
That's right, yeah, just at Melbourne alone. They're written usually from the perspective of, I guess, you know, the official press, and that doesn't always capture the role that the grassroots plays. So, yeah, it's good to see.
Well, yeah, actually, going through the book, there's a booklet, but there's also an oral history, which is accessible at the Commons Library. But what's fantastic about this is that you actually go through and you share with us how you succeeded. You tell us about the campaign.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we were learning as we were doing. I don't think anyone that was really doing it had much experience in this kind of thing before. So we learned a lot through the mistakes that we made. But I think what we learned most of all was actually creativity within constraints, really. And by that, I mean, of course, under Australian law, it's actually unlawful to take strike action and withdraw your labour during a non-bargaining period. And we had this really problem of underpayment, particularly in March. And so we had to kind of, I guess, resolve to use sort of student-type tactics or direct action tactics. One example of that, of course, is one of the best days of my life, for sure, which is when we mock auctioned off the VC Duncan Maskell's $6 million publicly supplied mansion in Parkville, which happened to be the exact amount that at that time we believed we were owed in wages. And just 15 minutes before that action, we were called by the university and informed that they would pay us back in full. And the feeling of joy of winning like that when you know you've done it yourself with your comrades, some few hundred of us, is just fantastic. Yeah, it's hard to describe.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Actually, I was at that mock auction, which...
Oh, you were?
Okay. Yeah, I covered that. I'd been covering what you guys had been doing for quite a while. And you created this entity called the Casuals Network within NTU, which was very important.
Yeah, it was important. It started before I got involved. I was away for a little while, but yeah, it was a really important thing, because I think it gave people within the union the opportunity to sort of take the tools up for themselves, but it specifically focused on what was becoming a growing cohort of staff. I think 7 in 10 staff at that time were casually or fixed-term employed, and which is a huge number when you think about it on just headcount basis for a university that has, you know, in excess of 10,000 staff. And really, it was a very democratic group. I mean, we would bring proposals to that group, they would be discussed and they would be voted on, and then we would carry that out. So I guess it was very grassroots in that sense, yeah.
But that was the power, because a campaign is long and people can lose heart. But there were strategies involved, basically what the university is doing is attacking some of the most well-educated people we have. right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they made a rod for their own back, I think, in that respect. I'll be honest, I think, it's a mix of incompetence and malice at the top levels. I think that they had, you know, a group that were educated and that were well connected with students and that were respected by students. And I think people were shocked within the community, but also when we started to get press coverage, they were shocked at the level of wage theft that was actually happening at, you know, a sandstone institution that was, I think at that time, a $2.7 billion revenue-generating institution with a VC making $1.5 million a year, which was Duncan National. And I think the other piece that I think is key is that with those sort of tactics, you know, we did have to break the mold a bit. I mean, we couldn't just do sort of rallies. We had to do things like occupy the Dean of the Faculty of Arts office, Russell Goldborn, 2 Fridays in a row. You know, and that was with hundreds of us in that office. And we did a sit down in there.
Well, that was fascinating because you made him uncomfortable. Because what he said was, "Oh, I'm not going to talk to you." And he thought that would work. But you guys said, "Well, we'll wait."
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think that's the key is how do you shift the decision maker to turn a no into a yes? I think you need to know what they value and what they desire, and you need to try to work against that. I think the funniest part about that was when Russell Goldborn, around that same time, he posted on his Twitter, I'm a rock of meekness in a sea, in a stormy sea.
So he reads books, eh? Yeah, that's hilarious. But there's also this other tactic that you used, which is very important for people to be aware of, inside and outside strategies.
Yep.
That's really important.
Yeah. I think the when we're really talking about, I guess, two tracks, or as we were calling it at the time, is like it's important not to rely too much on the courts. It's important not to rely too much on the Fair Work Commission, because I think sometimes it can be seen as a silver bullet.
Yeah, it's a delaying tactic of the of the Boswellers.
That's right. And, like, you know, to be honest, we were in negotiations with management. They admitted to the fact of having underpaid. They argued with us for probably 6 months about the quantum of underpayment, because this wouldn't accept that, you know, people were literally being paid half of what the hours that actually worked, for example, in marking. And we went to the Fair Work Commission the week before we were at the VC's mansion doing the mock auction. And the commission has no powers to order back pay, and the university representatives just go to us to take them to court. And that would have been a process that would have lasted another 1 year to 18 months. And I think relying on those direct action tactics and trying to pressure decision makers, embarrass them, try and put them in a position where they're worried for their reputations, because after all, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to stud their CVs in order to get the next job, you know, whether it be a director of CSL or, as the case with Duncan Maskell or whatever. So, yeah.
That's disgraceful. I mean, everything about publicly owned universities being used as stalking horses for the military-industrial complex is disgusting
100%.
To me.
Yeah, I think they're also places for... they're really places for CEOs or executives to find a way into the private sector. I think you see that with all of the commercialisation of research language that goes on. I think it's a disgrace, given that they are publicly owned when they're not publicly run, really.
Yeah, exactly. And but the interesting thing for all your members and all the fighters that fought this fight, that got the $45 million wage theft, and that's another thing. You called it wage theft. They wanted to call it back pay.
They did. They wanted to sort of say it was an administrative error.
Yeah.
They wanted to kind of say that, you know, it was just an oversight. You see that language a lot, because it really exploded after Melbourne and it rippled throughout the rest of the university sector, and it's still rolling on. And I can remember a time back then when we were told not to call it wage theft because that was too inflammatory. But I also remember when I first was a tutor and I started marking, and I said to my immediate superior, I was like, I can't get this amount of marking done in the time that's allocated. And he was like, yeah, you have to choose between your essay, the students, or, you know, being underpaid. So it was an open secret. Like, just accepted along by the structures that were there. And I think it was a sort of a case of each of the faculties was getting given budgets that were not enough to pay for the actual student load that they had, because they were trying to raise the rate of exploitation off the back of casuals. Casuals were scared. Casuals were afraid. I mean, and we didn't know each other. The beauty of the casuals network was we were meeting almost every week, often in groups 100 strong at the peak, and we were finding the community that we had been alienated from by virtue of being insecurely employed at the time.
I mean, really, what you illustrate is that what was going on at the most educated level of the population, and people who are working in exactly the same kind of sweatshop situation in retail and in takeaway, are actually your comrades in arms, and that the boss wallers are actually living fat off the land on the impoverishment of the entire population.
Entirely, yeah. I think the other thing that we really appreciated at the time was the knowledge sharing we got from other unions. Particularly, we had a couple of contacts at UWU around the My Chemist Warehouse campaign, which at that time had just won a massive securitisation drive, as I recall. And some of their tactics, which were about targeting the decision makers at that time, were really invaluable for us and gave us the courage and hope. And we actually had them come out and speak to the casual comrades at the NTU Casuals Network at Melbourne Uni, and it helped us to sort of change our tactical thinking, and that's how we kind of got to where we did with the tactics that we ended up using. I think as well, like, it's obvious that when you've got exploitation of that scale and casualisation that's run away that badly, that there's a broken system of some description as well, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the fact is that what was at stake for casualised workers at the universities were that they couldn't buy houses. They can't, you know, a whole range, can't go on holiday, can't do any of the things that are supposedly a citizen's right within a country like this.
I mean, the best story I heard of people paying back was a woman that spoke at one of the rallies, and she said that she was able to take her autistic son to the dentist now.
Oh, my God.
Like, another fella who got the highest amount of back pay that I saw across my desk when I was doing the applications for people, and it was nearly $90,000 for one individual, and he was able to retire, you know. So it was transformative for people's lives. No doubt about it.
Yeah, well, stand up, fight back. And it's funny, you know, this business about, inflammatory language. It does strike me that this concerted attack on the CFMEU is an example of this, because what you've got is banks and universities, obviously with their hands in the till, in a sense. What, have any of them gone into administration?
No, indeed. Yeah, I'm not surprised, but frankly, it shows you everything you need to know that despite that scandal, no heads rolled at Melbourne Uni, to my knowledge. Duncan Maskell ended up quitting 2 years earlier in his term because of the recent student encampments, as I understand it, or at least in the wake of that. So at the same time, there doesn't seem to be any particular consequences to them. I do know that the Fair Work Ombudsman did get involved shortly after we did, and they did fine the university. So there are minimal fines. But again, when it's a $2.3 million or $2.7 million institution, it's a drop in the bucket, you know.
You mean billion, right?
Yeah, billion, sorry, billion, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for going through this with us. And you must be a bit proud to be commemorated in the Commons Library like this.
Yeah, proud. I'm proud. Very happy that it's there. I hope that a lot of people get to feel the feelings that I felt in doing that work. Sometimes it's really hard, and sometimes it's really frightening and scary because you are taking on powerful interests and they will go after you. But the feeling of joy when you do gather strength from comrades and then act and win is like nothing else. So that was the main piece I wanted to try to communicate to people. So, yeah.
Thanks for talking to us today, Ben.